This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
And it gives me great pleasure to introduce, please put your hands together, to introduce to the stage Mr. Richard Parks and Paul Goldstein. Are they coming? Yes, they're coming. Here they are. Take your seats, gentlemen.
He came on the stage a bit quicker than me there, didn't you? Anyone notice that? Good. How many of you watched on Friday, the final part? Yeah, okay. Oh, my God. So just for that alone, because I like to get this out early before I climb into him, I think he needs applause, and he's going to get it for me. That was the most incredible. You know, this, so often we're always reminded, and the program did it with a very light touch, of the heroic age of exploration. And too often we see a so-called mummy's boy explorer out there, a pretty boy with a team of 30 and GPS and Kevlar and this. And then I tell you what, the first question I asked Richard was, "Who did you really do all the filming yourself?" And it's a resounding yes. And that in itself is a remarkable thing. But before we look into the South Pole and the peaks and the Yak Attack and all of this thing, you know, I first saw this guy live playing rugby, admittedly for the wrong country, but playing rugby pretty well all the same, admittedly with very different hair as well, an awful lot of dreadlocks there. And you were always going to stand out playing that. You can just imagine the opposition, get the guy with the dreadlocks, you know, the Flash Harry. But, you know, you got that shoulder injury, no need for detail, but you went to a very dark place. I think the BBC describe it. Sorry for this, mate. There followed frustration and anger. Any sportsman who is at the top of his profession, and which Richard was, and then gets a career-ending injury, is going to be there. And then, of course, we get the rock and roll, the brawling, and all the various tawdry stories about you. Some of maybe they were based on a little tissue of truth, but it was a dark hole. But you called it the cave, didn't you?
Yeah, it was. It was a really difficult period for me. You know, rugby had controlled all my adult life. I had turned professional when I was 18, and it was all that I knew. I didn't want to retire, wasn't ready to retire, hadn't achieved all that I wanted to. And I went into a really, really dark place. And I think one thing I'm proud of with the book is that although my story is related to high performance sport, you know, these are emotions that many of us can feel. You know, in this today's society, a lot of us have to retrain, change direction in life, and you know, these are really difficult transitions to manage. And I didn't manage it well.
No, I think, but this is a ridiculous comparison, but you know, the reason we all love the new Bond franchise is everyone was flawed. Suddenly, they were more believable. I mean, this is what. I mean, how many of you? Who watched on Friday night? Who put their hand up there? Did you get tearful? Of you? Yes, of course you did. You didn't. You're just hard, aren't you? You should be playing rugby still. But I mean, I was just willing you on. I mean, from that dark place, suddenly, and I don't like to do a litany, but let's be honest, in 2011, Richard did the seven summits and what we call the three poles. So that's North Pole, South Pole, and Everest, all in a calendar year. All right, think about that for a moment. In a calendar, I don't know what you did in 2011, but I don't think it was that. That is an extraordinary thing, but that, I imagine, was almost an epiphany or a catharsis for you. But then, was that the necessary narcotic to then make you think of, hang on, I can't stop here. This is just the start. Now I've really got to. Not that that wasn't challenging, but how do I top this?
Well, it wasn't so much the narcotic, but for me, it was the way that I managed that difficult period. For me, you know, I went into quite a deep depression. I didn't leave my parents' spare bedroom for 3 weeks, and it was a sentence from my late grandmother's funeral, which is the horizon is only the limit of our sight, that really gave me the courage and the inspiration to pick myself up and to channel my energies into something positive. And, you know, for me, the challenge was learning how to climb. At this point, I'd never climbed a technical mountain, and that was the challenge for me, you know. As a rugby player, integrity was everything to me. The only people I really cared about were my teammates, my family, and that's no different in what I do now. So for me, the challenge was learning how to climb so that I could actually climb the seven summits. I had no desire to be short roped or supported up them. And I feel really privileged and grateful to be here now, because that world first project became the first ever person to climb the seven summits and stand on the North and the South Pole in the same calendar year. That was born through people I met and sponsors that evolved the project into the world first. And that really was more exorcism, I think, than narcotic. But I feel privileged because now it's opened the door to this chapter of my life.
It is, because, of course, when you're playing rugby, you have this sort of cloak of immortality, don't you? It's either always going to be someone else, or it's certainly not going to be me. And then suddenly you're hit with this. But to come out of it, like, let's just run through the build-up, the recent Channel 5 series, which you can still get on iPlayer, by the way. For those of you feeling, yes, indeed, a keen sense of betrayal that you haven't seen this, the Yak Attack, that's just a ludicrous bike race. That nobody should be asked to go on a bicycle over that. 11 stages, 400 kilometres, stupidly high. And that was really just an hors d'oeuvre to the Jungle Ultra. Five marathons in 5 days. Think about that. Now, some of you know me, know I did five marathons in a week this year. Nothing like at his pace, nothing like in those conditions. I still feel like a pygmy sat next to him. Then the brutal, I love it, the brutal. I love the way they give them names. So if you were thinking of applying and you were sort of touch and go, you said, actually, no, the brutal. That's just absurd. One Ironman enough? No, two Ironmen. And yet, to me, it's just a paragon of discipline and efficiency that you used all of those essentially as a training exercise for what went on in Antarctica. Have you always been very disciplined like that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I as a rugby player, I battled fear and insecurities daily, and it was a character trait that I perceived as this huge flaw. And in fact, it's the privilege of being able to write my story in my book that's given me this clarity. But what I perceived as a huge character flaw actually is one of my biggest strengths. And my meticulous preparation and attention to detail actually is the foundation of my success in extreme environments. And they are pretty crazy, those events, and I'm sure most of you guys are thinking he's insane, but there was a huge amount of science behind that. And, you know, we picked specific events to develop skills and the toolbox of skills to translate into Antarctica. For example, the Peruvian Amazon Ultramarathon, that was a self-supported race, so carrying all my own equipment, my hammock, my food, for those 5 days, and self-filming as well. So managing the camera systems, the batteries, the lenses, having the mindset to frame a shot, to take a video diary when I was absolutely shattered at the end of the day. Although it's in a very different environment to Antarctica, these skills were transferable to the expedition. So there was science in the madness.
Well, we're going to go to the science in a bit, because I've spent a good part of the last few years in Antarctica. I always remember about 6 or 7 years ago, being in a whiteout and having to walk about 2 miles before I could get to my chocolate supply. This is a big deal. Those of you who walk, I remember thinking, oh, this is what they went through. No, Paul, that's not what they went through, and it's certainly not what Richard went through. And the way I loved it, the program, and I thought it was very, very well put together.
Thank you, Paul.
And it wasn't, it could have been narcissistic. It could have certainly been mawkish, particularly the happy birthday routine with your amazing partner. I don't know how you do that. That must have been destructive. It would have been to me, not to your amazing partner. But putting together all that food and then thinking, no, I'm not only going to try and beat the world record, but I'm going to do it with the lightest amount of food. Did you ever feel that was a mistake? That bit where he was eating that first one, and he didn't need to say, I could have had six of those. We all felt it. I mean, you were just taking that. Have you eaten Thai green chicken curry since?
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of my top three dishes. My meals.
Oh, good.
You know, I love Antarctica. It touched me the second I stepped foot on it, and I feel incredibly privileged just to have visited the continent, let alone had the opportunity to experience it at its most beautiful and rawest, solo and unsupported. But the nature of that expedition, you know, the challenge of traveling that distance at that speed was about efficiency and discipline, yes, as well as physical prowess. And you know, it was psychologically, I think it was equally, if not harder than physiologically. And some of the toughest days I had when the when I had days where the weather prevented me from moving and I was stuck in my tent.
It's just you.
That, the discipline not to just eat all my food.
Yeah.
It was really tough. And, you know, the little things often are the hardest. And, you know, but I had the ability to make those mistakes the year before, because I went, I undertook a similar expedition, solo and unsupported, the year before.
Yeah.
And made all these mistakes. The one day where I got stuck with weather and I ate 2 days worth of rations, like proper, like gorging, and then obviously hit trouble at the end of the expedition. Yeah. So, you know,
Running out of food and supplies is nothing new. No. Don't feel you're special down in Antarctica. Let's be honest, some very famous explorers have done that. But that really hit me, that there he is eating this. And then, because the weight was so important, that meal you could have eaten six of then became your sort of, your urine bottle for the night. It was like, God, that really brought it down. And talking of urine bottle, without any question, the favorite bit in me in the program was the whole cod piece. Brilliant. It was just fantastic. This was, for those of you who didn't see, this was when he began to freeze downstairs, as it were. He then had to knit. It was a DIY sort of Elizabethan codpiece out of his only remaining pair of trousers. I mean, your hands stiff with cold. I just thought that was TV at its, perhaps on the wrong channel, but it was just magnificent.
True. Thanks, Paul. Well, yeah. You know, it's actually frostbite down there. It's actually more common than you'd think. Well, not for you, more common than you guys would think. And you know, the margins were so fine. Every gram had to be accounted for. You know, the real tipping point with speed expeditions in Antarctica, especially solo ones, are weight and food rations. Yeah. And getting everything, even my clothing, down to the lightest possible gram was a science and an art. And I had had some trouble with one of my layers, and it was serious. You know, it would have meant the end of the expedition. It would have meant a life without children. It was really serious. But you know, one thing that keeps me going when it's minus 30, the tent's rattling, ice from inside the tent is falling on my sleeping bag. You know, I don't want to get out my sleeping bag. What drives me is a value from my life as a rugby player, and that's being part of a team. And it sounds insane, but I don't see the Antarctic expedition as a solo expedition. I see it as a team project that I did the last 29 days on my own. So the idea of giving up or quitting or not being successful was more painful to tell all the people that helped me get there and sacrificed, my mum, my dad, my girlfriend, my sponsors. So actually, I didn't want to give up. I didn't want to quit. So I did. I cut the bottom of my trousers off my Primaloft trousers. And made this this codpiece. It was a codpiece. I still got it actually at home.
He has it here, but I don't think
no. And I was able to continue. And you know, the flip side to that would have been a really awkward and embarrassing phone call with ALE, my logistical operator, saying, "Can you come and pick me up, Rich? Why? I've frozen my willy."
Yeah.
That wouldn't.
That's
have,
just not a phone call you can have, countenance. No. I mean, you had actually. I'm not going to say two bites, because you went off all full of hope, and after 3 days, the weather just. It doesn't matter whether you're the fittest, strongest in the world. If that Antarctic weather closes in on you, you know, it's bleak, which it clearly was. And then you were coming to terms with failure, frankly. Mm-hmm. You thought it was a write-off. Then you got the weather forecast, so you had to go back the 3 days.
Yeah.
And then start again. I mean, that took extraordinary fortitude, to use a correct polar word, a characteristic one at the moment. Did you ever sort of retreat into the cave a little bit then, or you think you're well clear of that, as it were?
No. The psychological demons were flying, were circling, certainly. And, you know, one of the challenges about extreme environments or about Antarctica or about solo expeditions is the nature of the environment. It puts a microscope on every decision,
yeah,
on every emotion, and you really live this roller coaster, which isn't relevant to the normal world because things are so extreme. And it was a really difficult period, you know. But But that's a challenge. That's what I love. There are no shortcuts. You know,
no mediocrity.
No, there's not, you know. And challenge, performing in extreme environments is a real challenge. And the challenge isn't overcoming Mother Nature, being better than her or being stronger than her, because you'll lose 10 times out of 10. It's about being one with the environment and performing alongside her. And, you know, that was difficult to get 3 days in, then to realize that the record was simply not going to be broken. And, you know, contemplate an airlift. And I only had budget for one airlift. So if it was an airlift, it would be in the end of everything.
Yeah.
But then to turn around and ski back 300 kilometers back to the coast to start again was, you know, it was a difficult period. But that's the challenge, you know, isn't it? That's the beauty of that environment, I think.
So you went back out, and just before I go on with that, I'm always interested, people who do, you've done Everest, you've done all of these things. Let's use Antarctica, but Everest, I'm sure, is the same. What is it you miss most? You know, you're out there, you're entirely, apart from a communications link, self-supportive. Yeah. Your team, as you say, has put you onto the podium, the pole,
absolutely, yeah.
As it were, onto the grid, everything from the chef doing the killer weight of the curry. And then you're out there on your own. What is it? Do you have cravings when you're out there?
Absolutely.
Give us a top three of cravings. Keep it clean, but...
The first one is porcelain, definitely.
Is what?
Porcelain.
Porcelain.
Yeah, proper toilet.
That would
actually
be it.
Sitting down to go to the toilet, I think.
Yeah.
I peed like a girl for about a week when I got home, just because I could. Just because I could. It's strange, you know. Your mind does play tricks on you, you know. That again, is part of the challenge. And each expedition is different. For my luxury is jelly bellies, you know, the little sweets that are like the shape, the size of a coffee bean.
Yeah.
I allow myself 7 of those every night, and that is my treat. That's my escape. The end of the day, you know, finish melting snow. I've eaten. I've filled my flasks up. I get into my sleeping bag. It's that one moment. That's the moment that I'm safe. That everything's finished. And those 7 jelly bellies are like heaven. And I've got these silly little rules that I can only eat one at a time.
Yeah.
I've got to guess the flavor. Try and guess the flavor. But you know, a really cool story actually. On this expedition, the latest one in Antarctica, I really craved a bacon butty.
Don't we all?
I love sandwiches. It sounds a bit like Joey from Friends. I do love sandwiches. and a bacon sarnie is just like, you can't beat it.
No.
And I started craving these
vegetarians, bacon. I'm sure there's other things you crave as well.
I started like imagining this bacon, this perfect bacon breakfast bap.
Yeah.
And it was, and I wrote it in a blog actually. And it was 3 layers of toast. It was toast. Then it was bacon and egg. Then it was a middle layer. Then it was sausages and tomato sauce. Then it was another layer. And this was like the perfect breakfast bap. Anyway, I wrote it on a blog. Anyway, forgot about it at one point. Anyway, I actually got to the pole, arrived at the pole. And there actually is an incredible operation at the South Pole. You got the Amundsen Scott Scientific Base and ALE. My logistical operators have a base camp at the pole as well. With moderate facilities, and actually incredibly, at the South Pole, the chef at the ALE camp had recreated this bacon sandwich, and honestly, it was just amazing. It took me about 3 hours to eat it because my stomach had shrunk,
and I was down to
nothing. But yeah. it was awesome. So yeah, that was the craving for this one.
The jelly bear and that's great. But also talking about I slightly trivialised, which was unintelligent of me, the cod piece. But
no,
the DIY, you know. Also, you snapped your ski.
I did.
I mean that I was. Oh no, I did not know deliberately on Friday. I watched it live. I did not know. I deliberately didn't want to know the outcome. Otherwise, it sort of compromises the show. But when that ski snapped, I threw him or whatever. I can't remember what was in my hand. I thought, come on, that's enough bad luck now. Because you'd had to go through the. I'm not going to be the quickest person, but I tell you what, I'm going to be the quickest Briton. Yeah. You had to make a change there, and you were by, you know, a number of, I think, hours rather than days, wasn't it? But that ski, that could have been the end, couldn't
Absolutely,
it?
Absolutely, yeah.
And it was a MacGyver job, wasn't it? You found...
I still love the A-team.
Yeah, that was a good...
I still love the A-team, yeah. It was, you know, that's the challenge is being... self-supported in that wilderness.
And but you didn't even have a spare, did
no,
you?
No, no. And no. Like I said earlier, every gram counted. Every gram had to be accounted for. So I didn't take a spare ski. But instead, and it was, my dad is still amazed. To forget all the other things I went through, my dad is amazed that I had self-tapping screws.
Oh.
He's like, how?
But who doesn't travel anywhere without such things?
Even just the other day, he was like, I can't believe you're carrying this. Anyway, but I had self-tapping screws. I had a skill set and some moderate bits of equipment. And I was able to use the camera bracket that my camera was attached to my polco, the sled, which carried all my gear on. And I managed to dismantle that and use the self-tapping screws and duct tape, because duct tape solves everything.
Yeah, it does.
To fix the ski. And it still flexed, but it got me through those last three or four days.
It was a key. And
It was a brutal blow, I'll be honest. I did think, you know, really... Really?
Mm.
But
that's interesting you mentioned your father, Richard, because I from having only seen your father on television for a couple of minutes, I mean, your parents are rocks, aren't they?
They're awesome. I wouldn't be here without them.
They have to be with a son like you. I think they've got to... Oh, he's off again. There he goes. But yeah, that's not great. You're seeing your parents sort of crying a bit at the... Well, your father didn't, but your mum said he did, which
yeah,
was something...
Yeah, he's...
But also, he was. I love what he said at the end. You know that he obviously has love and respect for all of his kids, but in awe of you. And that takes something. That was a terrific moment. Must have been a wonderful moment for you, because I got the impression, not that he's curmudgeonly, but that's not something, a compliment he throws around every day.
No, it's not. And
it still affects you, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah, it does. It really does. And I didn't know that until I saw the doco. For me, you know, I'm not a misogynist. I'm not, a masochist. Sorry, not misogynist. Forgive me.
Misogynist?
Guys. Yeah, I'm not that either, actually.
It's when he comes down to sea level, he sometimes.
Yeah. You know, I'm not an adrenaline junkie. I love what I do. I feel privileged to be able to do it. I feel privileged to operate at the top level of sport again. But it doesn't make sense without the people I care about. And, you know, it doesn't make sense without giving back and also having my family. And actually, it means the world to me, because I wouldn't be able to do what I do without them. But, you know, we spoke in the green room, actually, about the difficulty being able to call home. Because when you're out there, it's really easy. It would be easier to just switch off, to draw a line and to separate yourself, and nothing exists outside of my tent. And it would be easier for me. But then that would turn it into a selfish pursuit.
Yeah.
And that's not what I am or who I am. So actually learning the skills to be able to call home and to be able to involve my mum and dad and my girlfriend and my, you know, and people, whether it be through blogs, is really important to me. And I'm really proud of not just the book, well, not just the TV show, but more so the book, because being able to share it with people, you know, it's really important, because not everyone is as lucky. I work bloody hard, don't get me wrong, but not everyone has that opportunity. So,
but not everybody has your characteristics or indeed your discipline. I mean, as a question I asked Richard earlier was, did you ever get bored? And it was just an emphatic no, yet I'm thinking of the program or I've done, you know, I've done, what is it, 10 Kilimanjaros, you know, and those last ascents, when you're just putting a foot in front of the other, but you're just putting it in that cold, one ski in front of the other, yet not remotely bored. And that takes huge discipline. And you pushed it up. It was 40 kilometers one day, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I love that. And I was thinking, I kept writing down, he's done 33 now. You can see here, it says, God, 40. I put 33. 40. Shit. And I'm thinking, how high is that going to go? And I wanted to see that. That's the kind of thing that gets you going, though, isn't it? When you know you've done that, you must have been tempted to have more than 7 of those jelly babies.
I was tempted. But no, the challenge with moving, with covering that sort of distance at that speed, isn't, like I said, isn't about physical prowess. It's about discipline. And for me, the process was trying to improve everything every day. So I skied 1 hour and 50-minute blocks with a really strict 5-minute break. And if I didn't have time to drink or eat in that 5 minutes, I would only do one. If I couldn't pee and eat, I would only do one. And by the end of the trip, I was peeing, pooing, drinking, all those in 5 minutes. And my existence was controlled by the alarm on my watch, and I would start skiing it every day at 7, up at 5. I'd try and start before 7. That was the first goal, and then my alarm would go off at 8:15, 9:35, 10:55, 12:15, 1:35, 3:15, 4:35, 5:55, 7:15, 8:35, and that was my existence. And I didn't think longer than that 1 hour and 15 minutes. And you know, you have confidence in that 18 months of preparation that all those bits would come together and I would eventually get there within the time frame.
I'm telling you. And yet when you get caught snowbound in a whiteout, what was your distraction? I mean, that really brought it home to me. I mean, you did some pieces to camera and they were very... Oh, I mean, it tore at the heartstrings just to watch it. But it's not like you could reach for a sort of Tolstoy or something. I mean, how did you occupy yourself in that time? You can only sew so many cod pieces.
It's true. I only had one pair of trousers. The honest truth is I didn't have that luxury. I had two wobbles on that expedition. The first wobble was when I turned around.
Yeah.
And the second wobble was when actually I repaired that cod piece.
Yeah.
But afterwards I realized that, you know, I only took 29 days worth of food, which actually that in itself was nobody in history. In over 100 years of polar exploration, nobody had started a solo expedition from the coast with less food. Even Christian that holds the world record at the moment, he took more food. So everything was incredibly committing. And I didn't have that luxury. In one of the most powerful days, the most euphoric days, I worked with GSK to take some saliva and scientific samples. And the irony was that we looked at my stress hormone response. And you would think that the worst days, the most brutal days, the longest days, would be when my stress response was the highest. But actually, the one day that was my lowest stress response was actually the most brutal day. I remember it's 40.2 kilometers in a complete whiteout. 13 hours of skiing without horizon, without a shadow, inside a ping pong ball. The only thing to go on was my compass. And it was brutal, but I didn't have the luxury with my food rations to have those days off. But what I find fascinating is actually the hardest days were the most rewarding. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the purities that I love about Antarctica, because it's no different to life. You know, the harder we all work, the luckier we get, or the more we achieve, or, you know.
Was it, I mean, your satisfaction level, I mean, this is perhaps a slightly facile question, but you've conquered, you know, Everest. Could you compare? They're entirely different, but I don't. Who's been to Everest Base Camp here? Okay. How many of you have been to Everest Base Camp, have looked up to it from Kalapatar and looked up and thought, no, you're out of your mind? He's not out of his mind. He's clearly compass mentis. And that wasn't without its moments, was it, Everest?
No. Everest was leg number 7 of my 737 challenge. And actually, you know...
Don't tell me it was easy, please.
No, far from it. But I had one of the most incredible moments of my life on that climb. You know, Everest is arguably one of the most commercialized mountains on the planet. And I'm sure we all have different opinions of it. And many of us would have heard, you know, the horror stories from Everest, the people on the mountain, the queues. But actually, one of the most privileged experiences I've ever had was my summit day on Everest, because... as it was part of the 77 challenge, I arrived 3 or 4 weeks behind every other team on the mountain. I was late. We were summiting at the very, very end of the elusive weather window.
Yeah.
And actually, in a very small team, we were breaking trail. And we had the summit to ourselves. And that in itself will live with me forever. And something that, you know, I feel incredibly privileged to have experienced. You know, and putting that into context, I don't know... exactly, but we're looking between 2,000 and 3,000 people have stood on the summit of Everest, which is incredible when you think of the population of the world and the population of the world ever. It's incredible, and I feel very privileged. Like I said, I work bloody hard, but you can't take it away how lucky I am. But to put it into context, only 17 people, and of all the PR numbers, I do a lot of talks, and we talk about the fastest Brit, the first Welshman, only the second person to break the 30-day barrier. But actually, the number that resonates with me the most is number 17, because I actually was number 17, the 17th person ever to ski solo and unsupported from the coast of Antarctica to the South Pole. And that, you know, no matter how hard you work, that's an incredible privilege.
It's quite a CV. It really is. I think, strangely, despite the pain, and I'm sure everyone who's seen it or will watch it will live it with Richard. I thought you almost on the Yak Attack, this ridiculous bike race, because with the greatest respect, if you look at the world champion bikers, they don't look like Richard.
No.
They're kind of skinny whippets, wiry. They're a bit like climbers, actually.
Absolutely,
a bit like climbers. And I saw first time it was a whiff of almost comedy on it. I said, "Who is this big wing forward on there? What is he doing?" But that, I mean, you must have thought when you completed that with a good degree of pain, and I might add a good degree of humor as well, which has to help you.
Thanks, Paul,
and you've got other people around. You need that.
Yes,
that gallows humor is critical.
You have to have a sense of humor.
I mean, I saw you, and I can't remember. I did read it somewhere, but you lost, what was it, 2.5 stone after Antarctica?
Yeah. Well,
anyone wants to lose weight, forget all these diet plans. Yeah. Simple.
Yeah. The first episode of the Channel 5 series, what was the race, but and it touches on this, but what it doesn't explain, is obviously as it goes into the detail as well as the book does, is I had skied solo. I had a 43-day solo expedition in Antarctica, research and development, designing my own equipment, my clothing, my fuel, researching the route. And I got a few things wrong that we talked about earlier. Mm. And I'd lost over 16 kilos of body weight on that expedition. And the Channel 5 documentary had been signed while I was there. So I arrived back, a shadow of the man I was, frazzled. And with Channel 5 saying, okay, you've got to race this mountain bike race in 3 weeks.
3 weeks.
And I was in an absolute world of pain. And, you know, there's so many cogs that I'm so grateful for, different shapes, sizes, but every cog vital. And my physio, Nick, is one of my best friends, but, you know, she had hell of a job on her hands to get me just to the starting line and to keep me going throughout that race. But, but you know, that what I learned from that race, the recovery protocols that we put in place actually informed the entire year and informed the Antarctic expedition as well. But, it was. I love cycling and I love Nepal. And you put those two together, you think it would be amazing, but it was wonderfully brutal. Brutal.
Savagely brutal. And Nepal. Yeah. How many people have been to Nepal here? I'm sure, agree. Yeah. This is a fascinating country. You know, I have covered about a third of my notes, and we're running out of time, and it's your time now. So I hope you've been incubating some questions for Richard, because if you haven't, I've got loads more. Let's have it. We've got a magic microphone somewhere, and we're coming straight to the lady in the blue scarf, pashmina. I'm not quite sure what it is here.
Richard, how do you deal with ordinary life? Do you get bored easily?
How do I deal with ordinary life? I try and live it as much as I can, is the honest answer. I don't get bored, no. I love what I do. Most of my my time is spent training. I'm still a high-performance athlete. I'm lucky enough to work with the Welsh Government and Sport Wales, and I work with a lot of schools, and I'm a lecturer at the University of South Wales. So I have a really busy life, and I feel grateful. I live with gratitude that I'm able to earn a living doing what I love, because ultimately that is a privilege. You know, I am constantly planning, if I'm being honest. And it's quite funny. Last year, I came back from Antarctica, and I had two holidays last year, and they were both skiing holidays, ironically. So I am a bit of a glutton for punishment, but I went to a genuinely dark place with my injury, and I have perspective over it now. My father's a cancer survivor. You know, some of the motivation for my 737 challenge was losing my nan and my uncle Terry, and I have perspective. Many of us have our own challenges, but at that time, the bottom just fell out of my world. You know, it was my self-identity, it was my self-value, my self-worth. It was everything that I knew. I was institutionalized, for want of a better term, and And it was a difficult period, and I considered some really dark thoughts. And from that place, I never, ever want to go back. And, you know, that's not Spurs, but that is a foundation for a lot of what I do now. So, and although I can navigate to the South Pole, I struggle to find my way around the tubes here in London. So every day is a challenge for me, if I'm being honest.
Another question, please. Thank you. Who's going? Here we are at the front.
Shamai, I'm from Wales.
Hiya. How are you doing?
He does play for the right country.
Yeah, okay. Will you be at the Millennium Stadium on Friday?
Not this Friday, no. I'm going to the
Olympic. Okay, all right. Okay. Are there any Welsh people here? Okay.
Yay.
All right.
Yay. I just wondered how you prepared for mentally for the loneliness that you talked about, or just the monotony of just the snow day after day after day, and you said you were regimenting your hours. What were you thinking of when you were doing that?
How do I prepare for the monotony and the loneliness? That played a big part in those 18 months. You know, you can't shortcut a preparation for something like that. So going to Antarctica for a solo expedition was that first step, and every single bit of that year played a part in it. And firstly, you know, it's having an objective. You know, once you've set your goal, you can work backwards then, and you know, you always are driven by that goal. And for me, it was obviously to complete that expedition in that speed. And then it for me, it was about all the little bits. You know, it was about understanding what I could control, and then focusing on that and breaking it down into really small chunks. So the hour and 15 minutes, ironically, came from the double Ironman, where I had to run two marathons after 230 miles on the bike. And they were eight-kilometre laps at 1 hour and 15 minutes. So actually, that number became powerful to me. So, okay, I worked with that. And then all I thought about was that. And as I said earlier, you know, I was alone. I was low, but I never felt lonely. You know, I felt part of a team. I knew how much so many people had given and helped to get me there. And, you know, I had things in place. Like every seventh day, I had a note from my physio, mum and dad, and my girlfriend. So every seventh day, I had that treat. That was what I was working towards. Every seventh day, I made the phone call home. I had strict parameters. I was only allowed...
Did you have some music?
Was there a
particular piece?
Not really, no. For the phone calls, I only gave myself 2 minutes, so I didn't get emotionally overrun or things like that. So I had things in place to manage it. The music's funny, actually, because the expedition almost was like three specific chunks. The first week, just full of this emotional turmoil, just, you know, the doubt, the should I have gone, should I have left, whether it's the right thing to do, the weather. And all the music I was listening to was like sort of running parallel to that. So it was like hip hop, heavy metal. It was all that type of music you'd associate with a gym session or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then the middle week where I got into the groove and started to feel at one, it was, you know, more mellow. And I love John Legend. So it was all like John Legend and stuff like that. And then the last week, actually, I didn't want music.
No.
And I was just at one, and I just almost felt weightless. And actually, it's really fascinating, those three levels of performance.
That's very interesting. That is.
I waffle, I digress.
No, not at all. It's certainly pertinent to arresting the boredom. First time I did a marathon with the big tiger suit, I had an arm thing, I had the iPod, I had the whole playlist, didn't listen to any of it. Not a bit. Have we got another? We got time for a couple. Yes, questions. Madam.
Hi, Richard.
Hiya.
I just wanted to ask what you were planning next, because obviously I've been following you since 2011.
I actually met
you in Greenland when you were training.
No way.
Yeah, I gave you the M&Ms.
In Kulisuk?
Yes.
That is wild.
I think you owe.
I do. I haven't got the M&Ms.
Do you remember the
Sorry.
M&Ms got eaten by, I don't know, there was something rustling.
Did, yeah, the Arctic foxes. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
Oh, they will. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yeah, we came out.
They don't like minstrels, but M&Ms.
No, we had a little hole in the pulk, and they got in and eaten the food. Yeah, plenty of remember that. Lovely to see you again. That's insane, isn't it?
So I've been following you since 2011, and I want to know what's next to carry on following.
Wow. Well, I have another project in mind. Bless you.
Hey.
I am working towards another project. The nature of these things, and forgive me, it's still not public. You know, there's still work in progress.
I think you owe her.
I do. Maybe I'll tell you behind the stage or something. but yeah, it's in my nature to want to keep building, to want to keep going. I love what I do, and there's no reason to stop. One thing that I am really passionate about is the science behind the expeditions and the education behind it. So working with my partners, the next project will have a very heavy science skew on it and some clinical research to add to our understanding of some of the diseases that are affecting a lot of society, Alzheimer's, dementia, things like that. But I hope to be able to go public end of this year. But it's not the question you asked, but it's really funny, you know. I love what I do, and part of what I do, obviously, is the commercials of it. You know, I was born in Pontypridd. You know, my mum and dad are hardworking, but, you know, I can't afford to do what I do without commercialising it, without, you know, sponsorship and the television and things like that. And I love it, but my dream expedition would be to have an expedition without having to tweet about it, or without taking my phone, or without taking, you know, actually doing it with the people I cared about there, and not taking that. So I actually have a trip actually in Greenland that I'd really like to do on kayaks that I'm working towards, but that's like my personal project. The next big project is hopefully end of this year I'll go live with it.
Good.
Thanks for asking.
Well, you're going to take her email and you're going to let her know first. All right? If you're owing her confectionery, I think, at least. Have we got time for... We've probably got time for one more question.
Any more
if
questions?
Nobody else has...
can I ask one?
Yeah.
You seem to like the cold.
I do.
How did you know that? Do you think you might go somewhere hot? Are you just kind of cold kind of guy?
No, I like the challenge of performing in cold environments. One of the reasons why I picked the Peruvian Amazon Ultramarathon was I hate the jungle. And after climbing Carstens and trekking 2 weeks just to get to the bottom of the mountain, I vowed never to go back. So Channel 5 thought it'd be funny to send me back there.
Yeah, they're like that.
Yeah, but no, I don't. I love skiing. I love the cold. I love mountains. And I love performing at altitude. So I guess that's my direction,
that's
I guess.
Thing, yeah, cool.
Listen, I'm going to wrap this up. A few things have occurred to me along during this interview. And I started off by saying, initially when I knew I was going to be speaking and interviewing Richard, I have always been a little bit cynical over the past 20 years. Not because I don't respect what they're doing, but I just always think it's been done before. These explorations 100 years ago, it's the anniversary of Shackleton. Perhaps the greatest of them all, certainly the greatest leader of them all. But I think in that pantheon, I'm happy to put Parkes alongside Amundsen and Worsley and Wilde and Scott. For the discipline alone to do that. But there was something in the really early parts of some of the stuff that's been written, and you used the word once, which was institutionalized. I remember hearing that word in my favorite film ever, which was used superbly with Red talking about Brooks Hatlin in Shawshank. And this was incarceration, and they'd been in a cave a little longer than 3 weeks. And I love it because it's a perfect finish, because the strap line to that marvelous film is that fear can take you prisoner and hope can set you free. And Richard, you have given millions of people so much hope. You're an absolute inspiration. It's
Thank
been
you,
a
Paul.
Privilege.
Thank
it
you
really
very
has.
Much,
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Paul.
Richard Parkes,
Thank
everyone, and fantastic Paul Goldstein. Thank you.
Richard will be next door, spookily signing his new book, so please go next door and pick up a copy. He'll be there for a while.
Is Simon still there? He's gone.
No,
he's just gone, bless him.
Yeah,
yes, it's
perfect
Richard's turn.
Timing,
perfect
yeah.
timing, absolutely.
Thank you, very much, Paul.
Thank you so much. That was absolutely fantastic. Richard Parkes, everyone.
We'll be blogging and posting recordings of all the events live each day, so check back for more.